You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show is sponsored by Hearst Ranch. Welcome to Why We Cook on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm Erica Wides, your host. And this is episode number 35 of Why We Cook. It's hard to believe. Before I even get into what I'm talking about tonight on the show, I want to make a big announcement, and that is that as of today, beekeeping is legal in New York City. Woo! It's a big victory for urban beekeepers and bees in general. David Yaski, who is our city council member, was sponsoring the legislation about a year ago, and just today it was announced that it has passed, which is great. Remember, 80% of the food that we eat depends on pollinators for pollination. So without bees, no food. So that's pretty cool because I am a beginner, aspiring beekeeper, and I want to keep my bees in Brooklyn this summer, and now I don't have to worry about anybody busting me, and my bees will have a home shortly thanks to my friends here at Roberta's in Bushwick. So it's great news. Anyway, tonight's show, I'm calling the dead season. Although it's beautiful out today, and I'm feeling much more optimistic than I have the past few days. We just had the worst rainstorm in history here in New York this past weekend. It was pretty grim, but today it's amazing out. But anyway, I sort of feel like I've hit a plateau, or I've hit a wall, like in running when you hit the wall. I've gotten to this point where I'm really, really sick of food. I'm sick of thinking about it, I'm looking at it, teaching about it, talking about it. I get this way periodically. And even when I have a chance to make a meal for myself at home, I think about, well, what do I actually really personally want to eat or cook? And nothing really pops into my mind. Usually the first thing that pops into my mind is yogurt. All I want is Greek yogurt and honey or oatmeal. Not very interesting for a chef, I know. Just Greek yogurt from Trader Joe's and honey. And it has to be buckwheat honey from Silvermine Apiaries, which is a bee operation in Connecticut that's run by the guy who taught me beekeeping, Andrew Cote. His picture's actually in the New York Times today in the story about urban beekeeping. But his buckwheat honey in particular. I go through these phases where food just doesn't do it for me. I'm sure people in every profession have this. I'm sure there are painters who get sick of talking about art. You know, I'm sure there are architects who just want to go live in a tent somewhere or in a cave. If you tuned in to last week's show, last week I talked about foods that I don't like, but I'm supposed to like because I'm a chef. Things like natto and sea urchin. And I fear that I'm on kind of this negative spin with the show. Last week it was about food I don't like. This week it's about just being sick of food in general. I'm afraid that I may be getting negative, and I certainly don't want that to happen. So after this week's show, I promise to keep it more upbeat. Now the sun's out, it's warming up, flowers are blooming, everything's good. So as soon as this show's over, it's going to be the new, perky, optimistic Why We Cook. Maybe I'll lose all my listeners because of that. I don't know, but I promise. Anyway, so like I said, this happens to me once in a while. I just lose interest in food. And there are so many other things I'm interested in. There are so many interesting things in the world, you know, like bees or pondering how to design the perfect desk chair for short people. Or what do North Koreans think about on a daily basis when they're not thinking about Kim Jong-il? Or when's the next season of Mad Men going to start? Things like that, important things. And, you know, I start to wonder, like, how would my life be different if I had followed another path, if I hadn't followed this culinary path? I'm sure everyone has these moments of doubt. This falling off of the food wagon, this falling off of interest, I think coincides yearly with what I call the dead season, which is the name of the show tonight. The dead season is right now. It's these last months of winter you know, February, March, getting into April. There's no spring produce showing up yet. Nothing's growing yet. It gets depressing. It's, you know, how many more turnips can I eat? How many more freaking parsnips can I roast? Even though I love them, you know, it's enough already. And of course, if you look at the mainstream food media, you look at all the magazines, you look online, you know, all the perky face magazines are doing all their standard spring stories about asparagus and peas and ramps and strawberries. Strawberries. I mean, please, we won't see a strawberry here in New York, a local one, until the end of June. So I don't know what they're talking about with strawberries, but asparagus should be up soon. At least we'll be getting asparagus. Maybe, you know, in a month. Maybe. Ramps, definitely. If you don't know what ramps are, they're wild leeks. They pop up through the mud in the woods early in the spring, and they're delicious. But, I mean, how many ramps can you eat? They should be coming up soon. Peas, give it 2 months for local peas, at least 2 months. And I've even started seeing morels on restaurant menus, which is pretty funny because they're flying them in from Oregon, where it's been spring since February. My best friend Lisa moved out to Oregon a year or so ago. She moved out to Portland. And in like February, she said the cherry blossoms were blooming. They get spring really early out there. So the morels are already coming in from the West Coast, but we're not going to see morels here for a while. Last year when I was morel hunting, we didn't find anything until almost the end of May, late May. So we got a ways to go still. That's why I call this the dead season, because it is. There's just not much. I mean, it's okay, though. It gives us all something to look forward to. Part of trying to eat locally and trying to eat seasonally is that you just have to learn to be patient. You know, it's not the 24/7 availability of food. It's the waiting until asparagus is in season, and then you eat as much asparagus as you can stand, and then you don't eat it again until the next year, and that's how it is, okay? So I'm waiting. It's fine. I just woke up this morning feeling like I needed to kvetch about it for a while. We seem to be having our Yiddish word of the week on the show, so this week the word is kvetch, and I want to just kvetch a little bit about it, okay? And don't tell me to eat fiddleheads. I was talking to my sister this morning, and she said, what are you doing your show on? And I said, I think I'm going to do it about how there's nothing growing yet and, you know, early spring stuff. She's like, oh, like fiddleheads? I can't stand fiddleheads. I should have mentioned it last week. I just don't like them. And when I said that to her, she's like, you know, I really don't like them either. I don't really get it. They're overrated. And the reason I don't like fiddleheads is because one time I ate them in a restaurant and I got really, really sick from them. And after I did a little research to figure out why, and apparently there are fiddleheads that are edible, and then there's something called a bracken fern, and the bracken fern is not edible, but often foragers pick them by mistake and sell them to restaurants. And I have a feeling that that's what happened to me, because I was served fiddleheads and I was throwing up black sludge all night. It was really horrible. So since then, I haven't been able to eat fiddleheads for meat. I love the way they look. I think they're beautiful. And I used to play the violin, so I can appreciate their sculptural form and the allusion to the musical instrument. However, I don't want to eat them. I think they're just blech. So no fiddleheads. So I'm going to wait. I'm just going to keep eating my turnips and my parsnips and my imported spinach from California. I'm just going to wait. And, you know, it's not like you can't buy anything you want any time of year out of season at a supermarket. But, you know, I try not to. I can't do it completely, but I try not to. And my mood is sort of directly linked to what's available in the farmers markets here. A couple days of the week when I'm going to work, instead of taking the subway all the way to 23rd Street where I work, I'll get off at 14th Street so I can go to Union Square and pick up eggs and bread, because I really only like to eat eggs that come right from a chicken from a farm, not from a supermarket. And I like to get my bread from Bread Alone and stuff like that, you know, the year-round stuff. And so last week I was at Union Square and I bought some apples, which I knew would be a mistake because they were probably picked last October. But I wanted to support the market, and I've been eating a lot of grapefruit this winter. And grapefruits, incidentally, have been amazing this year. And I know they're not local. They come up from Florida, from Mexico, but I love grapefruit, so lay off. At least I'm not eating tomatoes. But anyway, those apples that I bought really sucked. And I knew they would. But the reason I bought them was because I wanted to remind myself of what it would have been like to live here in the Northeast 150, 200 years ago. This time of year, we would have been so happy just to have had a couple of fresh apples left in the root cellar that it would have been a major occasion. Most of our apples at this point would have already been eaten, or they would have been cooked or dried or stewed or rotten by now. So I wanted to give myself that like proverbial snap out of it moment and to remind me of how easy we have it and what an abundance of food choices we have here at, in any season at any time of the year. And you know, since I work at a culinary school and we have this curriculum that stays the same year round, irrespective of season, we often have things like blueberries now, you know, or Mexican asparagus in December. And, you know, the fridges at school are filled with that sort of stuff, but it really, I find it distressing when we have it. So as soon as I start to see some little ramps popping up through the mud or some, you know, fava beans turning up, I know the slump that I'm in will be over and we're on our way. And these last few weeks suck, but we'll all get through it together. We have to take a break. We'll be right back on Why We Cook. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Tonight's show was sponsored by Hearst Ranch. That was some crazy music playing there just now. I don't even know what that was. Makes me feel old. Anyway, welcome back to Why We Cook on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. If you like what you hear on the show, please go to the HeritageRadioNetwork.com website and click on Why We Cook and leave a comment. Let me know what you think. If you like the show, any comments, questions, criticism, I can take it. Let me know. You can also now join the Why We Cook page on Facebook. Just go to Facebook and look for Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network, and you can become a fan of the show there too. So anyway, I was talking in the first segment about the dead season, which is now, which is, you know, these few weeks before spring where there's nothing growing and nothing in the farmer's market and we're still eating the old cold storage apples and eating the turnips and the celery root and the rutabagas. And it's okay. I'm grateful just to have food. It's all right. I appreciate it. I know the wait will be worth it when the spring produce comes in. I just wanted to whine about it a little bit. A little kvetching. That's all. Anyway, a couple of years ago, I went to the Museum of Natural History. They were doing a lecture series about food. And I went to that. If you listen to the Naturalist show on this fine station, Bernie Wides, who does that show, he works at the Museum of Natural History, and he happens to be my father, so I get tickets to things. Anyway, they were doing this lecture series about food, and they did one on mushrooms, and they did one on bees and colony collapse disorder and honey, and they did one on dandelions, and all of them were fascinating. All of them are really great. The honey and bee one was actually what got me interested in beekeeping in the first place, and I'm going to keep you posted on my adventures in beginner beekeeping all through the spring and summer. My bees will be arriving from the bee factory in April, end of April. So we'll get a, you know, weekly update on the bees. And mushrooms, of course, are a hobby of mine. And when I go upstate every weekend in the summer, we go mushroom hunting almost every weekend. But the dandelion lecture I found just really interesting. There were things I did not know about dandelions, and it kind of like hit me right on the head. And I'm sure I've mentioned before here on the show my love of the Little House on the Prairie books when I was younger. I'm sure I mentioned it, I think. Well, I loved those books. I occasionally reread them to this day. And what I loved about them really was all the stuff in them about food and about survival and how that, you know, those hardy Ingalls, that hardy little family, you know, grew and hunted and foraged their food and then had to put it up to get through those long, cold prairie winters. Because, you know, first they were living in Wisconsin and then they were living in Nebraska, and winters were brutal. And I learned so much about all of that from reading those books that I actually, to this day, tell my students to go back and read some of them, because it's really, like, fascinating firsthand account. And I love to learn about that stuff, about how people used to have to provide for themselves for lean times and for tough times, and the techniques and the methods that they used to preserve and to prepare for winter. And I've done a lot of shows about that. We did the confit show, and we did the salt show, and the sauerkraut show. All of those are methods for food preservation. But I also really like to know about the wild foods that people would forage for in order to provide for themselves. And the woman who gave the dandelion talk spoke at length about how dandelions, along with nettles and other wild plants, were some of the foods that the early East Coast settlers relied on for survival at the end of winter. When they settled in the Northeast, all along the East Coast, you know, if they put away enough food for the winter and they got through, they were okay. But sometimes by March and April, they had run out of food and they would have starved if they didn't know which wild plants to eat. And lucky for them, dandelions are one of the first plants to pop up in the spring. And we think of them as like this horrible scourge that we try to get rid of and we dump all kinds of poison on, but dandelions are actually one of the best little food sources out there. Now, back in the fall, I did a show about greens, and I talked about the dandelion back then too. But let's revisit the dandelion, because it's spring and they're coming up. They're incredibly nutritious. They're super high in vitamin A and iron and calcium. And they were truly a survival food. They would keep people from starving to death. They would pick the dandelions and eat them. And they actually, you know, they come up in the spring. The little leaves come up, and that's when the leaves are tender and edible. And then they flower later in the summer. The flowers are edible, but they're really, really bitter. And once the flowers come up, the leaves become really alkaline, so you can't eat them then. But then in the fall, when the flowers die, there's a second set of leaves that sets, and then you can eat those leaves in the fall. So you get it on both ends. You get it in the spring when you're starving, and you get it in the fall when maybe you've put everything away already. And you know, you want to eat them when they're little and they're tender, because then they're not bitter. But one year at Passover, I decided to use dandelion greens as my Seder plate greens. You know, if you've ever been to a Seder, you're supposed to put out some kind of like spring green for dipping in salt water, and usually people use like parsley. I used dandelion greens one year, and it was good because, you know, not only were they a little bit bitter to remind us of our, you know, bitter oppression, but they also seemed to be an apropos celebratory herb for spring. Anyway, back to the dandelion. So the leaves are really nutritious, like more nutritious than anything you could really buy. And they're really high in beta carotene, more than carrots, which is pretty interesting. And, you know, like we try to kill them. People dump herbicide on them all over the lawns. And instead of fighting it, you should just give in and eat them instead. It's so stupid. And she also talked about nettles, which you may be familiar with if you spend time in fields or with horses. Stinging nettles, they're a plant that stings you and you get an itchy rash. But if you cook them, you deactivate the sting, and then they become really nutritious. Also, they actually are really, really high in protein. So anyway, thinking about the dandelions and the nettles and things like that kind of gets me out of my slump, and it gets me excited to think about food again. I'm not necessarily going to go out and pick dandelions. I mean, I live in Brooklyn, so I'm not going to go get them in Prospect Park, because there's probably like goose poop all over them and who knows what. But I like to know that they're out there, that if suddenly the whole grid collapsed and there was no food and I couldn't come here every week and eat pizza at Roberta's, I could go out into the park and I could pick the dandelions. And I did actually also see my first blooming daffodil this past week in Brooklyn. So that gives me a little bit of hope. See, that gives me the positive note that I'm trying to bring to this. Even though I'm complaining about the end of winter, no interesting food yet, I did see a daffodil blooming. And I also got a little gift at Hanukkah. It was really in my Christmas stocking, even though I don't celebrate Christmas. It was a little ceramic snowman that had soil inside and little basil seeds, and you cracked open the snowman's head and poured water in and put it in the sun and grew basil. And I did it, and the basil grew, and I have these teeny little basil plants now on my windowsill. So, see, it's incredible how such a teeny little thing like that can cheer up an old, jaded, kvetchy chef like me. Anyway, let's take a brief break here, and when we come back, we're going to change the subject completely. We'll be right back on Why We Cook. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. Our show tonight is sponsored by Hearst Ranch. So now I'm going to totally change the subject. No more whining, no more kvetching, and no more talking about dandelions. What I want to talk about is something that happened yesterday. I was teaching my class. I teach it at ICE in Manhattan. And I'm teaching a Mod 2 right now. We have 5 mods, and I'm in a Mod 2. And Mod 2 is sort of straight up technique. We start with all the techniques and plow our way through. And I hadn't taught a Mod 2 in a little while, and I had forgotten that on the third day of Mod 2, it's our third sauté lesson, we make a dish called filet of sole à la meuniere. But we really use flounder because they're cheaper and they're more available and more plentiful. And I personally like flounder better. Anyway, I had forgotten that we do this meunière preparation. It's very, very old school, very classical French. You don't see it much on menus anymore, but it's so good. So I demoed filleting the fish, and then I demoed making the dish. And every time I demo it, I go, oh, this is brilliant. It's like I forget how brilliant it is. It's like brilliantly simple. And it's really delicious, and it reminds you of why some classics are classics, because they deserve to be so. I mean, it's really like 3 ingredients. It's fish and butter and lemons, and that's it. And it works so perfectly together. Now, you know, a sole or a flounder meunière isn't really something I'd make at home, because at home, as you know, all I eat is, you know, Greek yogurt and honey and oatmeal. But when I have to do it as a demo, I'm always still just captivated with it, you know, that somebody sort of came up with it. And if you've never had it or you don't know what I'm talking about, it's you take a lean, white, flat fish, like a sole or a flounder, and you fillet it, and you lightly dust the fillets with flour. And that's where the meunière comes in. The word meunière means miller, you know, as in the style of the miller, as in flour, as in the guy who mills the flour. So yesterday, of course, when I said to my class, so what does, you know, a la meunière mean? It means in the style of the miller. Who's the miller? And I just got a room full of 16 blank stares because nobody knew what the miller was. But, you know, fair enough. They're young kids. Anyway, you take these dusted fillets and you heat up some clarified butter and you sauté them really quickly in clarified butter until they get golden and crispy and just cooked through, and you take them out of the pan, and then you put a big chunk of cold whole butter into that pan and you let it melt, and then you let it start to get all foamy, and then it starts to brown. The milk solids and the butter start to caramelize and turn brown, and you take the butter to this point where it's called beurre noisette, which means hazelnut butter, because the butter will get nutty smelling and it'll get this nice nutty brown color. You only want to go to beurre noisette. You don't want to go to beurre noir. You don't want black butter. And then after that happens, it starts to foam, the foaming subsides, the butter is noisette. Then you just squeeze in a good squeeze of lemon juice. And the cold, wet lemon juice stops the butter from cooking and mixes with the butter. The lemon and butter mix together and they sort of emulsify each other. Then you throw in a little handful of chopped parsley, and then you pour the whole thing while it's still foaming and bubbling hot over the fish. And that's it. It's like three ingredients. It's fish and butter and lemon and a little flour and a little parsley. But really, it's fish and butter and lemon. And it's so good. And it's so simple and brilliant and perfect. And I had totally forgotten that we do it in the lesson. And I'm always surprised when we do it at how good it is. The first really like French food I ever ate before I was ever chef when I was a teenager was a sole amandine, which is basically the same dish, but at the end you throw in sliced almonds into the butter and they toast up in there. And I think the almonds actually make it too rich. I don't want all those almonds with my fish. But it's basically, you know, the same thing. I prefer mine without the nuts. But it's still really great. And it takes like 3 minutes to make the whole thing. And you can also add capers to it and little chunks of lemon pulp, and then you get a sole grenoboise from Grenoble, which is also really good. One time I was eating at Artisanal in Manhattan, and they did a blood orange grenoboise, and that was really good too. And it's still blood orange season, so you could go out and get yourself some blood oranges and buy yourself a flounder and make a little blood orange grenoboise sole meuniere. But you have to get those blood oranges soon while they last, because they'll be gone and you'll be eating fiddleheads very soon. So we only have a couple minutes left here, and I want to make another announcement, and that is, if you listen to the show regularly, you know that I'm involved with Streets International, which is the program in Vietnam where I have been helping. I write their curriculum. It's a program to teach tourism and hospitality skills to disadvantaged Vietnamese kids, orphans, street kids, homeless kids. We house them. We teach them English. We give them life skills. We teach them how to cook, how to work in restaurants. It's a great program. And we have a yearly gala fundraiser event. And that event this year will be next Wednesday, March 24th. And it'll be at the Astor Center. And I will be there. I will have a station and I will be serving Hoi An style Vietnamese spring rolls. And there'll also be a VIP reception earlier. It costs more. And I'll be doing a demo at the VIP reception. So if you're interested in going to the event, the regular tickets are $150. The VIP tickets are $200. I know it's a lot of money and times are tough, but if you can swing it, if you want to come, it'll be at the Astor Center. You can get your tickets at streetsinternational.org, /tickets. Just go to streetsinternational.org and click on events. We would love to have you there. There are a lot of other great chefs coming. Tom Colicchio, Seamus Mullen, Floyd Cardoz. A lot of great chefs. It's going to be great food, great cocktails. You get a little gift bag, the whole thing. You can walk around. It's going to be a really fun night. Last year's was a big success. So that's next Wednesday night, March 24th, at the Astor Center, which is on Lafayette and 4th Street. And no fiddleheads, I promise, at least not on my station. So we are out of time. Thanks for listening to Why We Cook this week, and we'll see you next week.